Good morning. We're discussing here today the laws of Pesach. However, we're not discussing the laws of the Seder, which you know already. That's what I'm told. Rabbi Simon taught you everything you have to know about the Seder. Is that correct? If you have any questions about the Seder before I start, I'm happy to take those questions first. This is a follow-up to what Rabbi Simon said. Any questions? Simon says. All right. Nothing? No questions? Yeah, it's all clear? That's good to hear. So we're going to discuss a few minutes about the other laws of the Seder, of Pesach. Aside from the Seder, now, Pesach is one of those holidays that requires 30 days of preparation. And as a matter of fact, the Talmud teaches us that 30 days before the holiday of Pesach, we are supposed to be what's called Sholim V'Dorshim. We're supposed to ask and to expound upon the laws of the Passover holiday as it's upcoming. And according to certain authorities, this is limited to the holiday of Passover. It wouldn't apply to others because there aren't so many intricacies with respect to the other holidays. So we're out of those 30 days, about 24 have passed already. So I imagine you're already 24 days into your very in-depth search and analysis of these intricacies. But since we have 20% of the time to go, we can still give some wisdom so it'll help you in the last few days of preparation. It's interesting, the very first halacha in Shulchan Aruch in Hilchos Pesach tells us about the importance of helping those who have less than ourselves, what we call mo'os chitin, or buying wheat for those who don't have wheat of their own so they can bake matzahs and fulfill the mitzvah of the Seder. And the Rambam writes elsewhere, and it's quoted in the Mishnah Berurah at the end of Hilchos Yom Tov, that a person who engages in a delicious meal on Seder night, or the other meals of Yom Tov, as a matter of fact, and does not help the poor, so his belly is happy. Not him, just his belly is happy. We call it Simchas HaKeres. And that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for to make the person happy. For a person to be happy, you have to share with others. This is a very, very important requirement which the halacha has. It's actually built into the Hilchos Pesach in the very first simon. After that, we start talking about Bedikas Chametz. Now, Bedikas Chametz is a major area of halacha. It takes up the first part of Masechta Pesachim. And we are supposed to check the chametz to make sure that we will not eat it inadvertently on Pesach. Also because we're not permitted to own chametz on Pesach. Pesach is different than all other prohibited foods which we may own. Here we may not even own it. And according to certain authorities, based upon the simple reading of the Pesukim, we may not own it lest we in fact eat it. So we have to have a search and destroy mission, which is called Bedikas Chametz. The actual Bedikas Chametz takes place in our homes this coming Sunday night, which is called Oral Arba also, the night before the 14th of Nisan. And at that point in time, we're supposed to check for any chametz which may be in the house, and whatever we find, we're supposed to burn. We burn it the next day after we finish perhaps eating breakfast. We'll have breakfast, we'll put away a certain amount of food to eat the next morning, but whatever remains after that, we're supposed to burn. The most important letter to remember is B. B. Okay, B. B stands for Bedika, which is the first step. It also stands for, we'll call it something, Biur, which is the brach we make on Biur Chametz. We're supposed to eliminate or burn the Chametz. And it also stands for Bittul. Now, bittul, it means renunciation or nullification. And that takes place by Talmudic law just after we finish the Bedikah, Sunday night. And by Shulchan Aruch law, a second time, Monday morning. On the Sunday night, we nullify any chametz which we have not found in our search. The chametz we keep for breakfast, we're not nullifying. And on Monday, last resort, we have to nullify everything. We saw it, we didn't see it, we owned it, everything's gone. Now this bittul must take place when it's appropriate, which means when I still own the chametz. By Torah law, the chametz becomes ownerless at high noon, chatzos on Monday, which is now 1 o'clock, because we have daylight savings time. By rabbinic law, it becomes ownerless an hour earlier, which is approximately 11, a little before 11 o'clock in the morning. So the bittul must take place on this coming Monday before 11 o'clock in the morning. I think it's 10:58. Some of a different calculation of the times would be 10:40 approximately. So there are different times that a kaidah is precise. Before that time, we're supposed to make a statement which tells us that we make the following statement, that all chametz which I may own is nullified and is as meaningless as the dust of the earth. It's renounced. You can make it hefker. All this text is printed in now. So the Rambam should know what it says. If you don't know what it says, it's meaningless. Fine. This is the order that we have. Obviously, you're supposed to burn the chametz before you do bittul on it. So when you burn it, should be yours. So if you have to burn the chametz, let's say by 11:20 or so, in order to be able to do bittul by 11:30, you have to burn it. It should be completely burned through. What do you burn these days? Well, there's a custom of putting out 10 crumbs for the bedika the night before. Take those 10 crumbs, try to make sure they're made from soft bread or something that shouldn't be too hard to burn up into a crisp. That should be done. And after that's done, before the 11:40 or 11:58 cutoff, you're supposed to make that statement which is found in every siddur. You can make it in English or in Hebrew or in Aramaic, that you're renouncing and nullifying whatever chametz you may own, whether you know about it or not. This is the order according to the Talmudic and Shulchan Aruch law. Any questions? Yes?
I just had a question on the original idea that we're supposed to sell the chametz so that we can. It's like you said, it's a simple idea, so we shouldn't come eat it. But it seems like it's very limited to just Pesach, and we don't do it on fast days or anything.
That's a tremendous question. You've been preceded by about 800 years in that question. The Rishonim ask you a question. Why is the issue of Bal Yirah, Bal Yimotzeh, that you shouldn't own prohibited food, limited to Chametz and Pesach? Why doesn't it apply to other prohibited foods as well? The most common answer given, I think it's a very compelling answer, is Chametz is unique because we eat it all year long. Other foods which we're used to staying away from, so even though we may own it, we're not going to eat it. It's Chametz, I eat all year long. So I eat all year long, I may inadvertently eat it if it's in my possession. Okay, that's a simple sense. There are many others. Okay. One of them is that because chametz is a very serious prohibition, most prohibitions of food are, even if they're Torah prohibitions, under pain of lashings, of malchus. But chametz, like a very few others, is under pain of kares, which is a much worse violation. Okay? But you use the word selling, which I never used before. So I'll pick up on your word. Selling chametz. I never used that expression before until you used it. There's a tradition of selling chametz, which goes back, again, in its pristine, pure form, goes back to Talmudic times, but in the form it presents itself nowadays as a much more recent vintage. What you do with chametz is these days, you authorize a rabbi, and the rabbi sells the chametz to a non-Jew. By selling the chametz to a non-Jew, you're not in violation of owning chametz. It's not owned by you, it's owned by the non-Jew. This is how we take care of the problem for those of us who don't want to throw out so much chametz into the garbage. You may not be interested in giving it away to the indigent of the non-Jewish population. We can sell it to a non-Jewish individual with an understanding, even this is permissible, that should he desire to sell it back to us after the Passover holiday, we will give him a gentleman's agreement to buy it back. Okay, that's what happens throughout the Klal Yisrael. People authorize rabbis to sell the chametz. The rabbi sells the chametz. And after Passover, usually the goy is amenable to sell it back to us. Now the question, of course, becomes, how is this sale made effective? How do you make a sale effective in Jewish law? Not so simple. It's fairly simple to make a sale effective in Jewish law between two Jews. You look up in the Shulchan Aruch, how it's very clear. Between Jews and non-Jews, it's not at all clear. Not at all clear. We use a number of modes of transaction. I'll just rattle them off to you briefly. One is money. The non-Jew gives us money. He doesn't give us the whole money. It's probably too much money for him to give us. He gives us what we call in our language a down payment for each and every one of the purchases that he makes. And then we shake hands, which is in America at least, a typical way of closing a deal. Then, the non-Jew gives us an item of value, let's say a watch, a penknife, glasses, a hat, whatever he happens to have. It's called chalipin, and we exchange. I give him the chametz, he gives me the object. Then, what we do is we have to not only sell the chametz to the non-Jew, but we're required to rent out the premises on which this chametz is found to the same non-Jew. And by doing so, we are able to effect additional methods of transfer of the chametz itself. One is called agav, which means that the since real estate is primary and movables are secondary, one can transfer movables by transferring the real estate and the movables incidental to it. And number two, what's called kinyan chatzir, that whatever I own, if some movable is in my property and the parties are desirous of a transfer, it works. So we have now five separate means of transfer of the chametz itself. We have money, we have shake hands, we have what we call chalipin, exchange of an item for the chametz. We have what's called agav, which is it's incidental to the real estate, and we have chotzer. Once the real estate belongs to him or is rented to him, then he can acquire automatically. Then we have what's called a shtar, a document which memorializes all this. And a shtar is also a means of transfer for the leasing of the property. The document doesn't work directly for movables, but indirectly. But leasing the property, he's then able to acquire the chametz, as we said before, by agav and chatzer, aside from the three other means we mentioned earlier. This is all, it's complicated. That's why you do it through a rabbi. The rabbi knows how to do it better. And the rabbi is authorized by, ideally, by a direct meeting between the seller and the rabbi, makes the rabbi into his agent. Traditionally, it's done in writing. The seller writes an authorization form, authorizing the rabbi to sell the chametz to a non-Jew, and then ideally should be itemized. I'm selling A, B, C, D, and E, liquor, groceries, toiletries, and they're found in a particular location, and the value is approximately X. And this way, the sale is done in the best proper form, and after Pesach is over, the rabbi goes to the non-Jew and says, listen, mister, you owe me, according to these sheets, $1 million. And he says, all right, take $1 million. But usually doesn't do that. He says, well, I don't have the money. He says, okay, if you want, I'll sell it back to you. So we sell it back. After Pesach is over, how do you sell it back? Same way. You meet the non-Jew, you give the non-Jew back his money. That's what I do. I keep the money in my locker over the whole holiday. And then I shake hands and I give an item of value that I give him for mine. And voila, it now belongs to the non-Jew again. Any questions about Mechiras Chametz? I'm glad it's clear to all of you. When does the Mechiras Chametz take place? So typically, it takes place after the last time to eat the Chametz. Because once people are... I don't want to sell Chametz to people who are they're eating. That wouldn't be right. You're stealing from the guy, even though he doesn't care, but still, it's not right. So we wait until the last time to eat the Chametz, which is an hour before the last time to sell the chametz, which is an hour before midday, chatzos. These hours can be somewhat elongated hours, depending upon the time of the year. Now it's almost equinox, it's not elongated too much. It's called shos manios. And we start then in the sale process, till we go through a whole process till we finish it. There is an additional sale in my community, which takes place this Sunday evening, just before it gets dark. And we do this for two reasons. Number one is because there are those who travel to Israel, or Europe. If someone travels to Europe and Israel and sells his chametz through me, and I sell it at 11 o'clock on Monday morning, that's much too late. It's 5 or 6 o'clock in those countries, and it's already way past the noon witching hour, after which the chametz can no longer be sold because it's ownerless. So I have to do it on Sunday evening. And I do it for an additional reason for those who don't want to do Bedikas Chametz. The Mishnah Berurah writes, end of Siman Tav Lamed Vav, a big dispute. Do you have to do Bedikas Chametz if you're selling all your Chametz? So according to one opinion, the middle view, it depends if you sold it before the obligation to check, set in or after. So to satisfy that view, for those who are not doing Bedikas Chametz, we try to sell their Chametz as well on Sunday late afternoon, which is before Sunday night when the obligation of Bedikas sets in. That's as far as when we sell it. When do we buy it back? We'll have an appointment to meet the guy as soon as Pesach is over. I guess, a little more than an hour after sunset, a week from Tuesday. And when I do that, I'm very careful to tell him that some of my parishioners are in California, and for them I cannot buy it back effective immediately because the sun is still shining there. So I buy it back from him and do the actions now, let's say we'll call it 8:30 at night, but only effective for those people at 11:30 at night, 3 hours later. And if you find a non-Jew who's intelligent enough, he understands what this means. I happen to use a non-Jew as a real estate agent. He knows this very well. And he reminds me that in real estate, it's often that way. I do an action now, sign a contract now, effective January 1st, for tax reasons and the like. So he's fully aware of what the halacha recognizes as a maisa, an action now, but the chalos, the effect, to be postponed until some future time. This is what we do for those individuals who are west. And those who are east, we sell it earlier. There's some people not even sure whether east or west. We just don't know because we don't know what the dateline is. Anyway, from the coast of China to the coast of California, almost. I mean, this, almost. You have a quarter of the world is under a cloud. We're not sure what the dateline is. Because of the dispute, is it 90 degrees east of Jerusalem or 180 degrees east of Jerusalem? It's a bit of a complicated issue. So for all those people, we sell early and buy back late. And the non-Jew is aware of these intricacies. Okay? Yes?
Does the contract, should it stipulate at specific times, like say West Coast, East Coast, or could it just say wherever?
No, the contract of sale, which is very elaborate, is only one time, which is the time when it's exactly when it's contracted. Okay. So it'll be Sunday evening. We write in the document before 7 o'clock, and Monday morning before 11:40. Before. It can be any time before. Has to be done. I'm not taking any chances. I don't care what the guy's in California. I don't care. We're selling it early for him. Okay? Earlier than he would have to ordinarily. Buying back, it's an oral deal. There's no contract. So whatever we decide. Okay? Good. Any other question about Mechiras Chametz? It's very important. Okay? If you understand it, we'll move to the next topic. The Shulchan Aruch goes on in Hilchos Chametz to tell us about kosherizing utensils. Now, in the olden days, when people couldn't afford it, everything would be kashered. And you had to kasher things, you know. It's called kibolo kachpoto. The way the chametz came in, that's the way it goes out. And they would traditionally kasher everything. Today, we live in an affluent society. Most people have a separate set of dishes and a separate set of pots and pans for the Passover holiday. Who in this room does not? Who has a home which they do not have a separate set of dishes, pots and pans for the Passover holiday? So if they do, we won't talk about it. What we do have to talk about, though, the two major issues, the sink and the oven. That's not everyone has a special Passover. Who has a special Passover oven in the house? Yeah, you do. Wow, you're fortunate. Who has a Passover sink in the house? You do. You're also fortunate.
My parents are on my house.
Okay, good. It's wonderful. But most of us, plain people, have only one sink and one... If you have two sinks, they're used for both all year long and Passover, and the oven, if you have two ovens, they're also used both. So how do you make it kosher? So, it's a big dispute about how you make an oven kosher. The lenient views say, you just put up to the highest, leave it there for an hour, that's good enough. The strict view says, no, you have to take a blowtorch, make it actually sparks fly. I do not recommend that, it's dangerous. If you want to follow that super strict view, what you should do is hire a professional. You don't do it, it's too dangerous. The in-between view says, well, if it's a self-clean oven, that's good enough. Because a self-clean oven will get to, I think, 900 degrees, if I'm not mistaken. That's what I think I read in the... Huh? Is it true? Go online, see what it says about self-clean oven. I think it gets to 900 degrees. Which is considered to be hot enough to effect a kashering, as opposed to our regular ones only up to 550, which is a matter of greater dispute. So, therefore, if it's a self-cleaning oven, it's put onto the self-cleaning cycle. If it's a plain oven, if you want it to have the lenient view, just put up to 550, the highest for an hour. The stricter view would either require a blowtorch, which I don't recommend, or put in an insert. That's what I have, an insert which keeps everything in a box. What does it say online?
900.
There it is, 900, yes.
Two questions. One, how hot is the blowtorch?
Can't answer the question. I would never go near one.
Okay. Number two, I know a lot of self-cleaning ovens, you have to take out the racks when you do the self-clean. So
I don't think so. I just helped in my oven just yesterday. I think the racks were in it.
Maybe. Older ones. I don't know. Maybe the racks were
in. Look online. What do they say about racks in the cell pin sack? They tell you everything. Everything's online. I'm pretty sure my racks were in there yesterday and they made it. I'm pretty sure. But I was there. I wasn't looking carefully. Just yesterday, we self-cleaned the oven. Mm-hmm. We have two ovens. One we have self-cleaned, and one we put a box in, an insert. I don't want to rely upon the Molinian view by putting them to the highest, but those who have to rely on it, they have absolutely very good basis to rely upon that. Okay? Good. That's as far as the oven. As far as the sink, so what we do with the sink is, if it's made from stainless steel, you can kosher a sink. Stainless metal can be kosher. How so? With hot water. Given the fact that you don't put the sink on a fire, it's called iwui mikli rishon. You're pouring chametz onto it, so you can kasher it the same way by pouring regular water onto it. The water should be very, very hot. The way I do it in my house is I take two or three big pots, the huge ones, which haven't been used for 24 hours. The sink is also not used for 24 hours. I turn the drain on the bottom, right, so it keeps the water in. Then I say, okay, let's go. Take the big pot and go, pour it over the floor of the sink. Then I take the next few big pot or two and I pour it over the sides towards the bottom. And then when the sink is more than halfway full with this really boiling hot water, I'll then put on the tap water, hot water, which is also hot, not as hot. After it's all said and done, it takes a few minutes or two until it gets to the very top. That water is so hot, you won't want to go near it. Steam flying out of there. So therefore, the whole kitchen sink is kosher thereby. The trick is now, how do you release the drain? So we have one of those releases, it goes out with that very interesting vortex. That's a fascinating experience, which will probably be done today in my house. If you want to come and see it, please be my guest. That's what we kasher the sink. So we kasher the sink and the oven. The rest we really almost kasher almost nothing. We just buy new ones for Pesach. So the grates, we have new grates for Pesach. That's it. We bought new grates many years ago. By now, having used it so many years, I'm guessing we bought the grates over 30 years ago. Whatever it cost us, by now it probably cost about a dime per Pesach, a quarter. You just have to cost some money to amortize it over the mitzvah, many, many years of use for Pesach. It's really very inexpensive, and the best way is to buy different grates. Yes?
Granite, marble, countertops.
So countertops, I didn't mention before, because technically speaking, countertops don't have to be kashered at all, because what are you doing with them? They're dry. They're supposed to be dry all the time, and you don't put any food on it officially. So you put a chametz kapara on it last week, you put a pesach kapara on it next week. There's an expression in the Chazal, in the Svarim, based upon the sugyas, Ein balua yotzi mikli likli b'larotiv. Absorbed taste cannot go from one utensil to another without a liquid medium. And according to the classical commentaries, means a significant medium, a big puddle, not just a tiny bit of liquid. So it's a very small question to begin with, honestly. Nonetheless, people want to kasher their countertops. If they want to put boiling water over it, should work. Some use steam, which for this purpose would work. And if you ask me what they do in my house, they don't listen to me, they just cover it. So they cover it, so the kasher at all, just cover it. Cover it. Okay? So everyone has their own way of doing these things. Okay? Any other questions about kashering? I'm happy to take them. Okay? We're done with that. Sorry?
Fridge, just clean.
Fridge? Clean it.
No,
I hope not.
No.
Okay. Yeah. Now, so we've covered so far getting rid of chametz, which includes getting rid of the chametz from our utensils. We're now ready to talk about other issues of how we define chametz, for example. Chametz is defined, we know, it's bread, cake, things of this nature. What about cosmetics and toiletries? That's where it gets a little touchy. So I'll give you my view, which is shared by many, that if it's a liquid which pours like water and is made from chametz-based alcohol, you should try to get rid of it. You'll say it's ridiculous, it's denatured, it's cologne, it's aftershave, it's perfume, it's a roll-on deodorant, what else do you use of this nature? I'm just trying to think. What else pours like water? That's the baddest I can think of.
Medicines
pour like water. The answer is medicine's even more strict. The answer is these things that they may have been denatured by the government, because government has a whiskey tax. They don't want this abused as whiskey, but they're it's well documented that the individuals who are alcoholics will take the stuff and will either, believe it or not, consume it as is, or with a little distillation, 1, 2, 3, they separate the alcohol from the denatured and inedible stuff, and they enjoy it very much. So therefore, according to the stricter view, which I think we should try to follow, we should eliminate all this kind of stuff. If it's made from chametz sticka alcohol, by selling it to a non-Jew. If you have these books, they print that as a book from Los Angeles and from other places. They give you a long list of acceptable products, even though they're made from alcohol and even though they're poured like water, such as mouthwash and certain perfumes. A list this long of what has no chametz in it. It's made from synthetic alcohol. So why do we have to take any chances? There's so much synthetic alcohol out there. Well, I don't like that product of mouthwash. I want mine. I mean, come on, Scope, Listerine, these are famous brands. They're not some Yeshiva, Shacharedish, Satma brand. So there's no reason why you can't use these mouthwash, even if you use a different brand the rest of the year. Okay, contrast this with non-liquid items, which are non-liquid and inedible, in my view, is not to worry about, such as soaps and creams and things of this nature, powders. I think it's no problem. It's inedible, and it's made from some kind of chametz. Initially, it's no problem. So shampoos, things of this nature, toothpaste. But again, Colgate is kosher. So come on, why use anything else? They can give you kosher the Pesach. I think it's a major brand. I think so. I like the other brand. Okay, if you want to use it, you can use it. But not most of the kosher the Pesach anyway. Fine. This takes care of these. Any question about these things? About these cosmetics and toiletries? Medications, if you need it for your health, if you're seriously ill, so if it's bikuach nefesh, doesn't matter what's in it. Any less than that, so we try to use kosher lePesach medications if you can find them. A whole list this long. But if it push comes to shove, and you can't find a kosher lePesach medication, you need it for your health, even if it's not life-threatening, many poskim are lenient, it's not considered a food. It's just something, you just swallow it. Or if it's in a capsule, it just goes right down. If it's chewable, some are more strict, it's certain flavors. If it's liquid, some are more strict. It depends on the case. You should consult your local rav to find out how bad your need is. Maybe it's even kosher lePesach, as the charts, in fact, indicate. Okay? Any questions before we go on? Let's turn our attention to what kind of food we eat and don't eat on Pesach, which is not really chametz, but for many of us, we have accepted not to eat them. For example, Ashkenazim do not eat kidneys. Kidneys means, it's an expression, kitten, katan, small. Small, grain-like items, which are not really grain, but they resemble grain, and then some of this processed together with grain. And for this reason, Ashkenazi. Who's Ashkenazi here? That's it? Only have a half Ashkenazi. Not even half Ashkenazi? Okay, it's good, the way it should be. We have half Ashkenazi and half Sfarim. So Ashkenazi don't eat kidneys. How that's defined is a matter of dispute. Rice is considered to be kidneys by virtual authorities. There were those who wanted to include even potatoes, but that was too drastic, so that we assume potatoes is okay. And potato starch cake is the same as regular cake. It should fit in, they make potato flour, but it hasn't been accepted. That's stringency. New World products, which obviously not included in the original Xay, which goes back 800 years, are nonetheless included, which includes peanuts. One second. Quinoa is a major dispute between the various conscious organizations. The OU waivers, the Star K thinks it's okay, as long as it's made under supervision for Passover. Otherwise, you can have admixtures of wheat. That's the whole problem with kidneys to begin with. So, soy, some corn, these are New World products. We never existed. We still assume it's under kidneys. Again, this is for Ashkenazim. If someone is sick, there's a health concern, kidneys is okay, as long as make sure it's not real chametz. Yes?
How can
concerns that then wheat may get thrown in with these products.
Mm-hmm.
So just like quinoa, like if Starkey says, why can't you have rice made as long as people are watching it?
The answer is that rice was included in Exeter over 800 years ago, and we're not able to undo it. Quinoa is a new fad. It doesn't exactly resemble.
So really, it should work, but because of the Xera, like meaning it could work. But
it's a Xera. So Xera is a Xera. So we can't do anything. You're not permitted to dispense with Xeras, which are pan Ashkenazi. You cannot convert to Sephardism. That's not, in my view, permitted. Contrast this with a different stricture, which is not found in the Rambam himself, which is what we call gibrot. Literally means broken matzah, which is broken and soaked. There was a fear that the matzah was not completely baked in its first breaking in the oven. If you then have the not completely baked dough come in contact with liquids, bango, comes chametz right away. It's a terrible thing. So in certain East European communities, they do not eat gibrot. Western Europeans and Litvaks and other different people do eat gibrot. It's fine. I've never heard of this whole thing. So here, because it's it's not pan-Ashkenazic, there's much more room for changing within customs and people move from one place to another. Another stricture of Ashkenazim is not to eat egg matzah. The reason being that egg matzah is, in theory, if a little bit of water gets mixed into everything else, it could come chametz much more quickly than the typical 18 minutes. And therefore, except for older and sick and babies, we do not allow egg matzah to be eaten in the Ashkenazi community. It's fine, I've never heard of this again. Any questions?
Theoretically, if you mix flour and water, and it wasn't as thin as matzah, it was a little bit thicker, and even soft, but everything was done in 18 minutes, would it be...
That's Sephardic matzah. Are you Ashkenazi or Sephardic?
Yeah, Ashkenaz.
Who's a Sephardi? What's your matzah taste like?
It's regular matzah.
Like us, hot stuff?
It's not the thick one, it's not the thick matzah over there, no.
No, but it's hard.
Yeah, it's matzah. It's
excuse me, matzah. But the original Sephardi matzah.
The original matzah is thick, it's like pita. Yeah.
It's not pita, it is pita.
Yeah.
It's literally pita.
Yeah.
And it's kosher le Pesach. But I wouldn't eat it, because my grandparents wouldn't eat it. It's a Sephardi custom. But, you know.
So what's the problem with that, technically?
Nothing. This is Ashkenazim have accepted upon themselves for centuries not to make soft matzah. So I don't like to trifle with these century-old customs. We try to stick with our old-time religion.
Me too.
Okay, so that's why we have the hard matzah. All right, that's what we have. Okay. I assume that Rabbi Simon covered the entire Seder from beginning to the end. So we'll leave it out. And we'll discuss just a few other holiday-related issues which are not Seder-related directly. Pesach, like any other holiday, has its laws of its own. One may cook on a holiday. By rabbinic law, one may not ignite a fire on a holiday. It's a big problem in the new kitchens that have electronic ignitions as opposed to the old-fashioned pilot lights. You gotta transfer a fire, you may not start a new one. So it's a big problem. You can't do it. So you have to either leave it on from before Yom Tov or live without.
That's what this is?
I'm sorry?
It's just before with the pilot light, you can actually turn it from off to on?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. You're just transferring. You can't put it back off. That's the problem. Because that's what's called kibui, not havara. That's a problem. Unless it's necessary to heat the food, which is
not in the apartments, we have a pilot.
Yeah, all the old-fashioned ovens have. It's Jimmy Carter's fault. Who heard of Jimmy Carter? You heard of him?
President.
Okay. He's the president. Yeah. Jimmy Carter, after the Arab oil embargo, declared the moral equivalent of war in his trying to conserve fuels. So all the big time ticket items and all the cars that are guzzling gas at incredible rates, that's fine. But he wouldn't allow any more, a little tiny Ner Tumah. There used to be the, every kitchen, you can't, too much. That's why I insisted on electronic ignition. So it hurts us in a few areas of halacha, including Hilchos Yom Tov, legacy of Kar. Okay. On holidays, again, there are certain restrictions which we have to be careful about. And some which are in fact, subject of dispute, controversial. One may only do various melachas, such as cooking, on Yantar, because it's what's called Shava L'chol Nefesh. Acha She'yocha L'chol Nefesh, the rabbis explain Shava L'chol Nefesh. Everyone has to eat, but things which are not are problematic. And there are two controversial matters today. One of them is showering, one of them is smoking. So let me say this, start with smoking. In my opinion, smoking is prior Torah prohibition all year long, even not during the holiday, because it's dangerous to your health. I'm starting with that. But on Yom Tov, over and above, is an additional prohibition of Yisir of Havara on the holiday. Because nowadays, thank God and thank to the Surgeon General, people start smoking, so it's now a minority phenomenon, and it's not called Shavu L'chol Nefesh. Not allowed to do it. Showering used to be prohibited by Torah law. Simple read of the Gemara, because people didn't bathe. What about bathing? Bathing was not a popular activity in those days. They didn't have any hot water. They had no running water, even cold. No hot water except in the public bathhouse. And people would just go a week. We'd be the clean ones. We used to take a bath in Erev Shabbos. The Black Death was blamed on the Jews because we didn't die. And we didn't die because we were the cleanest. We were the cleanest. We went to the bath once a week on Erev Shabbos. I remember once visiting on a Revolutionary War site somewhere, and they showed us in the bedroom was a little basin. What's this? Well, they used to go to the river and get some cold water in Washington. How often they bathe? In the cold water? Once a year. They'd go into the river. That's why it was so much disease. They never cleaned themselves. That's how it was in those days. So it was not called Shavu'ot L'chol Nefesh to bathe in hot water. Today, according to most authorities, it is. And therefore, strictly speaking, it's permissible. Although by custom, we don't even shower in cold water, even on Shabbos, and Shabbat Yom Tov too. So in a pinch, a person, B'Shas HaTzchak, can rely on the linear view. But ideally, you should take a nice, good shower before Yom Tov and then wait until after Yom Tov for his next shower. That's ideally, at least by custom. Okay. The holiday of Pesach has some unique... Yes, I'm sorry.
In terms of the shower, I mean, on Shabbos, the only problem isn't just the water, it's the toweling off and all that.
Exactly, the toweling off, the
schita. Those still apply, I think.
Exactly, that's why the custom exists on Yom Tov as well. Right, precisely so. Okay, so we've discussed the laws of the Passover holiday in terms of eliminating the chametz and eliminating the... One thing I forgot to mention before. There's a custom to burn chametz. It's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. But pashtus, you should burn your last chametz. But your last chametz has to be after the you sell chametz, if those of you who do. So it gets a little bit crunchy at the end of the day. You have to sell the chametz. You don't want to sell the chametz as long as people can still eat it. So you sell the chametz at the beginning of the fifth hour. Then you have to sell it. Then you want to subsequently burn it. You burn your last bit that you don't sell to the guy. I tell the guy, these 10 crumbs in this bag that I put out and I found in my B'dikas chametz, I'm not selling to you. Then I burn it. And then I have the bittul subsequently. So you have a lot of things happening in one shot. Those of us who have to go to work and can't just burn it right after the mechira, they're not around. They're my shul. We sell the chametz. We have a fire outside, finish the sale, go to burn. People go to work, and they're not on shul. So I'm in the burner in the morning. I can't be against it, but burning in the morning, it's a nice custom. It doesn't really burn your last chametz. Your last chametz is being sold by the rabbi to the non-Jew, which may itself be a fulfillment of what we call tashbisu. Because the Torah says tashbisu from mi batechem, from your homes, from your possession. Very possible. When you sell it to the non-Jew, that itself is a fulfillment of tashbisu. And that's what we rely upon for those who can't burn it after the sale is done. Again, so we discussed eliminating chametz. I should also add one more thing. Can't leave chametz in your garbage can. Because even though it's in the garbage can, it still belongs to you. The can belongs to you. Now that you can't even leave chametz in a garbage bag on your property, it still belongs to you. If you want to get rid of it, you have to get rid of it and put it beyond your property line. In certain communities, we have dumpsters in Riverdale. It's a dumpster. You can take all your chametz and dump it there. So you shouldn't leave your chametz in your property or in your can, even beyond your property.
What if your partner is in garbage?
Partner in garbage? I mean,
for lack of a better, you're renting in the car building.
I rent, so.
Okay, so you don't really own your garbage.
What? When it's still in my, when it's in, you mean after I throw it down the chute?
Yeah.
Ah, good question. After I throw it down the chute, I have a part ownership in it. I really own it completely. Let's say I threw out my garbage, and I realized it's a diamond ring in the garbage. And I tell the super, I'm sorry, the car belongs to me. Think he'd win the case? I doubt it. I think the ring is still mine. So the chametz pie also is still mine. But you do bring up another point.
That's one thing. With the ring, you had an intention to keep it. With the chametz, after you throw trash down the chute.
I'm not sure. Say I threw out chametz and I threw out Cheerios. I thought that breakfast was done. It's not done. You can give me Cheerios! And it's down the chute. If you have the Cheerios, it may also be mine. I don't know. But you do bring up another issue, which is what about ownership of stocks? That's a very serious problem. Because there, I do own something. And there are some people who sell their stocks on their forms that they authorize the rabbi. I don't think that's possible. I can't sell a stock. You need a stockbroker. I can't just sell stocks. My view is you don't have to sell the stocks because although you do own it, it's not in your control. Botechem means under your control. Shalom and Bishuso. Shalom is yours and Bishuso means it's under your control. If I walk in with my stock to General Foods, General Mills, and say, give me Cheerios, give me Wheaties, they'll say, go jump in the lake. Because I have a stock certificate, it's worth $10. Jump in the lake, go to the store and buy it. So I have no control, it's different.
If you do have control?
But then it would be different, that is a problem.
You're on the board of directors.
Board of directors of McDonald's, I don't know what that gives me. I don't know, they may tell me to go and jump in the lake.
If you're a director?
Not sure.
You could appoint...
I'm not the majority owner, I'm only one director, there are 100 directors.
Your vote has
it. My vote is easily outvoted. I don't think it's a problem. But if it's majority Jewish ownership, that is a serious problem. And this leads us to what we call Chometz Sha'avah Lava Pesach. Whatever was owned by a Jew on Pesach is prohibited after Pesach. This is really now the post-Pesach part of our discussion. And this is a very serious problem with stores that are owned by Jews and are open on Pesach. Big problem. So often the rabbi will go in and sell the chametz, but that sale, if it's done typically, is meaningless because it'll only help for that which the Jew owns at that time. Even that's questionable because he's selling it to whoever walks off the street later on. And moreover, if there's more deliveries brought in on Pesach, that my sale today won't work. So the sophisticated rabbis sell the company. They sell the company to the non-Jew. This way, whatever comes in on Pesach is going to the company, which is owned by the non-Jew. That has to be done in a very sophisticated fashion. You rely upon it in a pinch. There's now a discussion about distributors. You need to go to a non-Jewish owned store, but the distributors are largely Jewish. And if they own the stuff on Pesach, it's a problem as well. If it could go on for weeks or even months after Pesach is over. What's it called? CNS. I think it's the biggest distributor. I think it's called Santa Cohen and Siegel. Two nice Jewish names. They control a fortune. They have much they own. Rabbi Teitz, Shlita, tries to sell their chametz by not selling individual parcels, by selling the entire company to a non-Jewish person. And there are those who are relying on the sale, those are not happy with it. But the bottom line is we have to rely on it, otherwise you can't buy anything. So who knows how long after Pesach is over. But if it's a store which is sold in a not such a sophisticated way, then I would be careful about buying there. Again, every store has its own situation. Most of these stores are owned by goyim, including, believe it or not, Waldbaum's. Used to be owned by Julia Waldbaum, but she sold out to goyim, European goyim from Germany or Holland. They own A&P, they own Waldbaum's, they own Food Emporium. It's a real conglomerate. Own many such things, no problem, because they're owned by goyim. Again, the distributor problem we spoke about before. Okay, just one final point to discuss post-Pesach is Sfira. Sfira is a Passover-related mitzvah. It's a Mimochras HaShabbos. We begin the day after the first day of Pesach, which is what we call the second night of Pesach. We count for 49 days until Shavuos. And it's important to get every day in. Don't forget, if you forget it, to count one night, you can make it up by day. If you forget by night and by day, then you're cooked. You can no longer count with a bracha for the rest of the Sfira. You count without a bracha. Unless maybe someone else makes a bracha for you if you go to shul. So you should try. That means we're finished. You should try to not to forget. If you go to shul every night, you'll have much less chance of forgetting. The details of Sfira I'm not going to go into in terms of the mitzvah. It's printed in the Siddur. But just to end with one thing, there was a minhag of semi-mourning during Sfira. So Rabbi Akiva's students died. This was traditionally held, as I think Sfarim do to this day, and many Ashkenazim, from Pesach until Lag BaOmer. Correct? But certain Ashkenazim, for various historical and other reasons, started keeping it at a later time, from Rosh Chodesh Iyar until Shavuos, approximately. You should follow your family custom, whatever it is, in this regard. If you're invited to a wedding, in time when you're not supposed to be making weddings, you're allowed to go, because it's the person that was within his rights to make the wedding. At that time, he had to be the opposite minute than you had. So that's okay. Now, there are certain other traditional customs. We don't sing, we don't dance on Sfira, and some people don't even have music on Sfira, which is itself questionable. But whatever, every person should follow his own custom when it comes to these matters. And I'll leave the floor open for a few minutes. If anyone has any question on Yichus Pesach, feel free to ask right now. Yes?
So in terms of wedding, if someone makes wedding the first half Sfira, and you normally keep the first half Sfira, do you have to keep the second half of that year?
No.
Go to the wedding.
Go to the wedding, dance. You still keep. I'm opposed to changing it. Although Moshe allows it, it's hard to understand why. We whatever our minhag is, you keep it. Stick to your family custom in this respect. Any other final questions? Yeah.
I heard you go over the issue of Yashan.
That's not really related to Pesach, but I guess it is in a certain way. The Torah says, and we're going to read it in the Torah reading of the second day of Pesach. It's a pasuk. Easter of Chodesh. Chodesh again consists. It's for the same five grains, and it applies b'chol mosh roseichem, which seems like it's saying it throughout the world. But other Tanoim say no. Just tells you that the prohibition did not begin until we got into Eretz Yisrael, but it's limited to Eretz Yisrael. It's very well it should be. The mitzvah tluya ba'aretz has some connection to the land. It's an agricultural mitzvah. Moreover, connect with the spheres with the omer. It's the korban omer, which releases the prohibition on the second day of Pesach. So Sfaradic custom is to follow the stricter view that Chodesh applies in Chutz La'aretz. Prevailing Ashkenazi custom is to follow the more lenient view. Chodesh does not apply in Chutz La'aretz. So therefore, in America, there's no problem. Even though the Rambam doesn't say that, look at Aruch HaShulchan and other sources, they tell you at great length that this is so. There is another matter of dispute. Assume you want to be strict, or you're a Sephardi, or a strict Ashkenazi, what's included in the prohibition? Where's the cutoff date? So these new machmirim, the cutoff dates are very, very early. Rosh Hashanah already, even before Rosh Hashanah. It's already, everything is presumed to be from the new grain. Others have a different view. It's what we call LIFO, last in, first out, and with the grain surpluses, etc. The claim is made that not much of the of this is really Chodesh. Maybe there's nothing as Chodesh, some claim. Winter wheat is certainly not Chodesh. So there are different things that you can use to avoid this issue. Again, prevailing minhag Ashkenazi Jew is to be lenient in the matter, and those who want to be strict should can pick their book that's written about how strict to be based upon their guidelines. Any final questions? Yes. That's it? Done? Good. I wish everybody a Chag Kosher v'Sameach. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.